The Problem of Evil, Part 4, the fourth talk in a four-part series, was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 13, 2012, as part of Gutenberg College's 2012 Summer Institute, What the Bleep Can We Know? The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right. So on page 11, and but so just to review the ground where we've been on, you've got the argument from evil against biblical divine determinism, but depending upon whether you accept the premise or not, you could accept the conclusion that, or you could reject the conclusion that biblical divine determinism is wrong and make that a premise, in which case you could prove that given that biblical divine determinism is true, there must not, cannot be an excusable evil in the world. So it really comes down then to just which premise do you find more compelling? There is an excusable evil in the world, or biblical divine determinism is true? And which weighs more? The proponent of biblical divine determinism gives more weight to biblical divine determinism is true. The detractor gives more weight to, I'm sure there's inexcusable evil in the world. Well, there's reason why they give weight to that, and that's what we've been assessing, is look at the evil in the world, look at the suffering in the world. What are the different factors that make people look at that and think that, sure enough, lo and behold, there's inexcusable evil in the world? And we've been evaluating that, and we've come to a point where my contention would be we don't really have a firm judgment to make a judgment whether there is or isn't. Maybe there is inexcusable evil, maybe there isn't. Maybe the suffering in the world is inexcusable, maybe it isn't. How would I know? It really, given the nature of reality and the nature of God's relationship to this world and my relationship to the world by contrast, I don't have the standpoint from which I could possibly make that judgment. I'm kind of flying blind. I don't have enough information. So that leads us to end. An assessment of the evil and suffering in the world leads to an impasse. Perhaps there exists inexcusable evil or inexcusable suffering in the world, but it is equally possible that there does not. We do not have a standpoint from which we could make that judgment. We would have to know the whole story of reality and have access to the inner experience of every human creature in order to have an adequate standpoint from which to make such a judgment. Why do the detractors of biblical divine determinism think that there exist compelling reasons to embrace premise one? There's inexcusable evil in the world. Well, they believe, due to specious assumptions and to the distorting effects of our instincts, they believe that it's obvious that premise one is true. It's obvious that there's inexcusable evil in the world. Okay, that's what we've been looking at. Now let's turn, why do the proponents of biblical divine determinism think that there exist compelling reasons to reject premise number one? And that, let's look at that now. I think there's four reasons for believing that God, who authors everything, is a truly good being, and therefore that it cannot be the case that reality contains inexcusable evil. So you see what I'm arguing. If we have compelling reasons to know that the author of reality is good, then it follows by inference that the reality he's creating wouldn't contain inexcusable evil, because that would be inconsistent with him being a good author, a good being. So that's the logic of my position. So do we have any reasons to know that the author, or have compelling reasons to believe that the author is a good author, is a good being? And I'm saying yes. There's four things that stand out to me. There might be more, but there's four things that really stand out to me. One is the moral nature of ordinary everyday experience. And this is ironic, because that's the very thing that the detractor of biblical divine determinism is pointing to and saying, look at all that absurd, inexcusable evil out there in the world. Well, I'm saying, no, they have a distorted perception And if we think about this in the right way, actually the opposite conclusion is what we would reach. So looking at ordinary everyday experience, we have every reason in the world to think that the author of reality is a good being. In truth, the occurrences of evil and suffering strike us as horrible and tragic. And why do they strike us as horrible and tragic? I think because they strike us as a violation of the fundamental nature of reality. We have a striking sense that they ought not be. Why is that? Because they are a jarring departure from our ordinary expectations, which arise out of our ordinary experience. So we go through life, and life tutors me in what I should expect out of life. What do I learn to expect out of life? I basically expect to be taken care of. And when that fails, it's striking and jarring to us because it is so out of sync with what my learned expectations are. Our assessment of the fundamental nature of reality comes from our overall tacit assessment of our everyday ordinary experience. Our experience-based expectations are these. We expect to be protected, fed, cared for, and so on. Jesus appeals to exactly those sets of expectations. He appeals to just this tacit assessment of reality in Matthew 6:25-34, where he talks about, observe the lilies of the field, how they neither toil nor spin, yet God arrays them in garments that match the glory of Solomon, and the birds of the sky, I can't remember what all he says, but God just takes care of all of his creation. He takes care of it. That's true. Most of God's creatures, most of the time, are cared for. Any exception to that is part of God's providential knowledge and purpose. So you do have, that's in Matthew 6 that I was referring to. In Matthew 10, remember he says, a sparrow is, you can buy it in the marketplace for some pittance, but not a single sparrow falls to the ground, but the Father knows it. But what's interesting is he doesn't say, now sparrows don't fall to the ground. Yes, they do fall to the ground sometimes. Sometimes it's part of God's purpose that there's an interruption in his basic fundamental benevolence where he cares for us. There can be an interruption of that, a departure from that, but not without God. God's intimately concerned about that. He cares about that, and it wouldn't happen if God didn't have purposes in mind for him violating or departing from his basic fundamental benevolence. The benevolence of ordinary experience is so normal that we ignore it. We don't even notice it. We take it for granted. It's invisible to us, largely invisible to us. We really have to work to remind ourselves, stop and think about how much you've been taken care of. But we don't normally focus on that. We just take it for granted. The benevolence is so normal that it is invisible to us. We see and count the suffering and evil we encounter, but we don't even see the goodness, the blessing, the benevolence that come from our ordinary, everyday, normal experience. Stop for a second to consider how truly exceptional tragedy and extreme suffering are. That's why we're shocked when tragedy happens, when the tsunami in Indonesia hit. Why is it so startling and striking and tragic? Because it's so unusual, that something on that scale. If we do a thought experiment, if evil and suffering were as likely to happen as good was to happen, in other words, every next second there's a 50-50 chance that it'll be harm rather than good that happens to us. If that were really our experience, would we ever be shocked by evil and suffering? Doesn't it shock us in part, at least, because, one is those instincts I was talking about, but also doesn't it in part surprise us because it beats the odds? It's the unusual, it's the abnormal. normally you're not surprised. I say shocked, but let's use surprised. Normally we're not surprised by something that has a 50-50 chance of occurring.
Tables, wow!
Amazing. Okay, another way to think about this, how many total hours of my existence am I basically well cared for and provided for? How many total hours of my existence am I not? I mean, if we just counted up the hours, I think it becomes obvious that most of the time, God has been taking care of me quite well. We are shocked at the occurrence of a devastating natural disaster, but for every day of devastation brought about by a natural disaster, how many hundreds and thousands of days of normalcy, safety, ample provision, basic well-being, etc., for hundreds and thousands of people led up to that tragic day where there was a departure from that pattern? In terms of the sheer number of days, care and benevolence is the rule. Tragedy is the exception. In ordinary, everyday reality, benevolence and care prevails over suffering and tragedy. If we were to give God the credit that is due him for every little gift and blessing, the score, it seems to me, isn't even close. Ordinary, everyday human experience is a series of tragic storms moving across the surface of a vast ocean of divine benevolence. We are surprised by the storms, but we just take the ocean for granted. Okay, the argument from evil ultimately depends for its power on painting God as a moral monster. That's what Ivan Karamazov was doing in the Brothers Karamazov. It's painting a picture, depicting God as a moral monster. While everyday experience cannot prove the perfect goodness of God, it certainly cannot prove that. But while it can't prove the perfect goodness of God, it certainly compellingly refutes the moral monster picture of God, it seems to me. So my ordinary everyday experience does not prove that God is good, but look at what a compelling, substantial reason it gives to me to make me consider the possibility that the author of all reality is not only good, but even maybe flawlessly good. That's not an implausible conclusion to reach in light of the benevolence that we see, the providence that we see at work in everyday reality. So that's the first factor, the first reason. Second reason is I look at my own personal experience with suffering and evil. My personal experience with suffering leads me to conclude that all the suffering I have and will experience is meaningful, purposive, and productive in my life. All of those things. It has led to whatever wisdom and understanding I have. It has arisen out of my confrontation with, my dialogue with, my doing battle with God in the midst of suffering. That's where I learned what I learned about myself, about God, about reality, about existence, why I exist, and all that kind of stuff. Yes, I've read the Bible, but that's just grasping it with your intellect. Where do you really own it and make it your own? It's in confrontation with God in the midst of suffering. And I know that, and I can look back on things in my life, and I could say, because of the fruit of what happened there in my life, what it meant in my life, what it did in my life, I would do it again. At the time as I was going through it, I thought I was going to go crazy. It was excruciatingly painful and I couldn't shut off the pain. And yet, when you come out the other side of it, as excruciating it was, if that's what it took to get me here, if that's how God chose to get me here, then so be it. That it was well worth it. And I'm not just arguing from, you know, cause and effect. You know, it's not just the outcome. The whole process was, I can look at it as meaningful. And I have had some episodes of suffering where even in the midst of the suffering, this is not always true, but even in the midst of the suffering, I felt loved because I was suffering. That is, God was making me suffer. And I knew it was God that was making me suffer, and therefore I knew that I was the focus of his creative activity. I knew that I was important. I knew that I was significant. This was not nothing that was transpiring here. This was something really substantial. And that's fine. That's what I want, is for my existence to mean something. Now, since I have personal experience with my suffering being meaningful and good, it does not follow. I don't know why I have, since I have personal experience with suffering being meaningful and good, it should be, it does not follow. Oh, I said, it does follow, I cannot know. I meant to say, it follows that I cannot, but rather it does not follow that I can know that the suffering of others in the world is similarly meaningful and good. I have no basis for knowing. I meant what I said.
You're right.
I meant it, yeah. Since I do have personal experience with my suffering being meaningful and good, it follows that I can't know that theirs is not meaningful, which is what the argument of evil is wanting me to think. No, because their suffering may be just as meaningful as mine is, that I know from direct experience with my suffering. So I can't write theirs off as absurd and meaningless. I have no basis for knowing that it is such. Therefore, the suffering and evil in the world do not provide incontrovertible evidence against the fundamental goodness of reality. So I look at reality, and what it looks like to me is God is beneficent. Yes, there's suffering in it, but my own suffering has been very meaningful. So maybe their suffering is meaningful too. Maybe it's not in conflict with what I see and the overall beneficence of reality. It's totally in sync with it, totally compatible with it. That's my point. Now, the meaningfulness of my suffering does not prove that all human suffering is meaningful. That's not my argument. But in light of my experience, it is certainly plausible that all human suffering is meaningful. Hence, in the absence of any evidence to the contrary, it is entirely rational to assume that the suffering of human existence is not in conflict with the basic beneficence of human existence that I see in everyday care of God for me in reality, in ordinary experience. Okay, third reason. My understanding of God's self-revelation in history, as that's recorded in history, in the scriptures. So we don't just have ordinary experience. God has actually revealed himself. The author of reality has actually entered into history, taken on a character role himself within human history, and revealed to us something about who he is. So that's significant. If I want to know something about the author of all reality, what has he shown me about himself? Well, the scriptures talk about his interaction with Israel, the people of Israel, and they talk about his interaction with us as human beings and mankind. And I can get to know this being through the roles, the personas that he has adopted in playing a role within history. The Bible speaks directly of the moral character of God. It tells us, in no uncertain terms, I think, that declares him to be and depicts him to be good. So if we grant authority to the Bible, that's an important piece of information. I think that this is the explicit teaching of the Bible is not particularly controversial. I suppose if you were pressed to make a case for it, it wouldn't be quite as straightforward as you might at first imagine. But I don't know that that's a particularly controversial claim, that the Bible teaches that God is good. But apart from the Bible's explicit teachings, its explicit assertions, the history of God's disclosure of himself to the people of Israel and to mankind, revelations that are recorded in the Bible, they always reveal him to be a good being. The moral character of God, the transcendent, is unknowable. The God who, from his transcendence, creates everything, he creates good, he creates evil. He creates light, he creates darkness. He creates reward, he creates calamity. I mean, all of it is his doing. So if I just had to go on, well, what does God produce? Well, he produces a bunch of good stuff and he produces a bunch of bad stuff. Is he good or is he evil? Well, that's hard to judge. But we don't have to judge merely from what God has done from his transcendence, because, point B, therefore, I don't know why I have therefore, the moral character of God, oh yeah, can only. Therefore, the moral character of God can only be known as it is revealed in the roles he plays within the history and reality, within history and reality. God has taken on several roles. He's lawgiver, he's judge, he's the God of Israel, he's the redeemer of mankind. I mean, there's several roles that he has taken on for himself. Within those roles, God reveals himself as one who is for good and against evil. And therefore, I think he's telling us something about his character. He's a God who rewards good and condemns evil. He's a God who delights to reward good and considers it tragic to have to condemn evil as evil. It is his role as judge over all the earth, in his role as judge over all the earth, in his role as lawgiver to his people, in his role as protector and benefactor of his people. No matter what role we see God in the scriptures, he conducts himself in accord with what is good and just, and never in accord with what is evil. So, my point is, if we go beyond just ordinary everyday experience, we find these very special and particular ways in which God has told us something about himself by taking on a role within history. And within that role, how does he play that role? As a good guy, not as a bad guy. He's always good. He's never evil. I think he's telling us something about who he is when he does that. And then finally, my understanding of the role of Jesus, and therefore of the moral nature of Jesus. According to biblical teaching, the moral character of God is revealed in the man Jesus. Jesus is said to be the image of the invisible God. John describes him in chapter 1 of the Gospel of John as he's the translation of God. No one has seen God at any time, John says, but the only begotten Son, he has translated him. And that's how I would translate the word there, translated him. So Jesus just is the character and person of God translated into a language, translated into a medium that I have access to. Do I want to know whether God is evil? Well, look at Jesus. You know what a good human being is, don't you? Well, there's Jesus. He's the reflection, the image of the person and character of God. And I think that's critical because God is so distant from us at times. He seems so distant. He's not, but he seems so distant from us at times that it's hard for us to know how to read him, if you will. But we know how to read another human being. We know what it's like to be a human being who's loving, who's merciful, who's just, who has integrity, who's truthful, who's righteous, who's whole, and so on. And the question is, what was Jesus? And all the evidence we have is that the disciples were pretty impressed with the goodness of Jesus. So, who is God? He's who Jesus is. Jesus is the most accessible and clearest translation of the moral character of God. He is God translated into the medium of a human life. The eyewitness testimony with regard to Jesus is that Jesus is utterly good. The one dramatic action of Jesus on behalf of all mankind, to die for our sins, is the most elegant and dramatic statement of the love, and therefore of the goodness of God. If God is who Jesus is, it's pretty impressive. Because what Jesus did, one who was absolutely innocent and absolutely just, allowing himself to be unjustly tortured in order that I might have life, is an incredible act of love. And all you have to do to recognize how incredible that is to put yourself in his shoes. You know, the Father comes to you and says, Jack, how about I take you and let you be tortured so that all the rest of mankind can have eternal life? And my response is, hell no. I'm not signing up for that. Because I'm not that loving. So you want to know who God is? Look at this man, Jesus, and how profound the love was that we see manifest in him, that's how loving God is. That's how good God is.
And by the way, all those people you're going to die for, hate you.
Exactly. They hate me. And they hate you. Yeah, absolutely. So, taken together, and there may be others besides these four, but these are the four that are most, that kind of stand out, most prominent in my thinking. Taken together, the four reasons listed above make a compelling case that God, the author of all reality, can be assumed or can be judged. I can conclude that he's a good person and not an evil person. Hence, these make a compelling case for rejecting the notion that God's creation contains inexcusable evil, because why would such a God, who is as good as I conclude that he is, why would he make a reality with gratuitous, meaningless, absurd, unnecessary evil? So while I can't know from my own standpoint that created reality doesn't include that kind of evil, it doesn't make any sense, because I know the author. I think I know the author, and the author wouldn't do that. Why do the proponents of biblical divine determinism think that there exists compelling reasons to embrace premise number two, that is, that biblical divine determinism is true? Why do we, people like me, think that there's compelling reasons to embrace that? To believe premise number two is right on the grounds that biblical divine determinism makes the most sense of all that the Bible teaches and espouses. And that's a whole other paper. In fact, that's a whole other book. And for $8.88, I'll make that available. Why do the detractors of biblical divine determinism think that there exists compelling reasons to reject divine determinism? Given that biblical divine determinism is incompatible with inexcusable evil in the world, and given their firm and confident belief in the reality of inexcusable evil in the world, it's impossible for them to even consider the arguments in favor of biblical divine determinism. I don't know if any of you happen to be at the, I don't even know what to call it. It was an event where I was standing up on the stage with Udo Mittelmann, who was arguing against the sovereignty of God because of all the inexcusable evil in the world. He was talking, I was listening. So it wasn't exactly a debate, but he wasn't about to even consider the possibility of biblical divine determinism from my perspective. I mean, why would you? Why would you give any credence to that at all? Because what loomed large in his mind was, all this evil out there makes no sense. Don't you lay that on God. Don't you be saying God's responsible for that. Because I just know that it's something that would be utterly incriminating of God, so don't even think about it. So it's not like he had considered my position and rejected it on any sort of merits of the position itself. He wasn't even going to think about it, because that evil out there is just way too incriminating. And I think that's what most people are who reject my position, is they haven't even given my position a chance. Or it's not my position. I think it's the Bible's position.
What was his name?
Udo Mittelmann. I didn't write it in here. I don't think.
Well, the names in the epilogue seem suspiciously familiar. Like Jacques.
Oh, yeah. Just the other guy. So they reject divine determinism just because it seems obvious to them that God cannot be the author of all the absurd evil and suffering that they assume exists. So it's just obvious without even thinking about it that biblical divine determinism is not true. But my question to them is, and to you, is how firm and confident ought these detractors to be in the reality of inexcusable evil? Are they really on a solid basis for just assuming that it all makes no sense and it's all absurd? I don't think so. I think there's all kinds of reasons why we need to check our judgment about that. So let me just end here by reading through this dialogue, and then for any time we have, we can discuss this and anything else. So, yeah, Alasthea is just the other guy, and then there's Jeopardy. I understand all the points you have made, but I am still not particularly satisfied. There remains a problem that you have not answered to my satisfaction. Jeopardy, so what is that? It just seems to me that some suffering that evil people inflict on others is so horrible and so extreme that it is difficult to believe that a good God is responsible for it in any way. And I tried to think about the most horrific thing I could think of here. Think about an evil man who rapes a two-year-old, for example. It is utterly horrific to contemplate the terror and pain and damage that the evil man is inflicting on the child. You've not yet convinced me that a good God would employ such a horrific evil to bring about some good. What good could possibly come from it? Jacquides. Okay, let's talk about your example and see if you can come to if we can come to some clarity. What is it about your example that makes it particularly problematic in your eyes? Is it that the evil is more extreme than other examples of evil? Or is it that the horror you feel is more intense? Other guy. Well, certainly it feels more horrible to me, but I think it is more it is a more extreme evil. I think the evil itself is excessive. Tell me then, is it more evil than a husband treacherously betraying and deceiving his wife by having an affair for a decade and pretending that he was being faithful to her? Other guy. I think so. That is certainly evil, but it doesn't strike me the same way. I don't find it as unthinkably horrifying, probably because it doesn't involve a child. Jacquides. But why should the age of the victim of my evil have anything to do with how evil I am? The other guy. Well, because a child is so small and helpless and vulnerable, it is so terribly evil to take advantage of a child's helplessness and vulnerability. Jacquides. But hasn't a trusting wife made herself vulnerable as well? Hasn't her trust in her husband rendered her vulnerable? He's taken advantage of her trust and using it to deceive her. That is treachery. That is the evil of his betrayal. It is not clear to me that he is any less evil than the child rapist. But how can a man hurt a child like that? That is what strikes me as so grotesquely aberrant. Certainly, the child rapist is engaged in aberrant behavior, and it is grotesquely aberrant precisely because it is so terribly unnatural. It violates every instinct that a human being has to nurture little ones. But I think you put your finger on what it is you feel. You don't feel that the child rapist is more evil than the treacherously deceitful adulterer. Rather, you feel that he is more grotesquely broken and twisted with regard to his impulses, and that he is more extensively abnormal with respect to what should be normal human instincts to protect and nurture a child. I absolutely share your feelings in those regards, but however more grotesque the rape of a child might be than other human evil, I think it strikes us as extreme in the extremity of its grotesqueness, not in the extremity of its evil. So far as evil goes, I think it is just one more example of human evil. It is just one more example of rebellion against God, against goodness, against truth, against nature, even to the point of totally disregarding normal human instincts. So as far as evil goes, it is no more and no less problematic than any other evil. Either God can use it to bring about good, or he cannot. Either it can be meaningful in purpose in creating a meaningful and good narrative in the reality that God is creating, or it cannot. I don't think the degree of horror that it induces in us is relevant to the issue of whether it can be meaningful and purposive. Perhaps so, but just imagine the terror and horror that the child herself would experience. How can a good God even imagine creating such a thing? Again, we have to separate the evil of the act from the suffering inflicted by the act. He can imagine the evil by extrapolating to that which he is not, can he not? And as for the suffering, now that's a different matter. Can you imagine any suffering being meaningful and good? Or do you think that all suffering is unnecessary and meaningless? Viktor Frankl, the Holocaust survivor who became a famous psychiatrist, is famous for his perspective that suffering is essential to making existence meaningful. If he is right, then it cannot be suffering per se that is the problem. God can and does use suffering to create meaning in existence. So what is it about the suffering inflicted that seems so unthinkable to you? Again, I think it is because it is a child. A child cannot understand. A child cannot see the meaning in his suffering. A child cannot grow and become deeper and become better because of suffering he or she has endured, it seems to me that such an event is just an absurd, meaningless nightmare to a child. Yes, it is easy to see how it would seem so, but let's be careful to distinguish what we know is true from how things seem to us. If the ultimate goal is to determine what sort of perspective we are going to take toward the Creator, don't you think it is necessary to make such a decision on the basis of what we actually know, and on the basis of what's not on the basis of what seems like it might be the case? Yes, certainly that is true. So do we actually know that a horrible, terrifying event in the life of a child will not and cannot ever be the cause of anything ultimately meaningful in that child's life? As I argued in my paper, certainly we can imagine it that it does not. We can imagine that nothing ultimately meaningful comes from it. But in real life events of such a nature, do we actually know for a fact that no good comes from them? No, you're right. It would be rather arrogant and presumptuous to say that I know that no good can or does come from them. I just don't see what it could be. Granted, and I am in total agreement with you there, I am just as perplexed as you are at what possible good outcome could come from such an event that would make a good God want to cause that to happen in any of his creatures' lives. But are we in agreement that it is not a matter of you and me knowing what good might come of it? Rather, it is a matter of whether it is reasonable to think that God could mean it for some ultimate good? Yes, in terms of the issue at hand, you are absolutely right. So for the sake of whether biblical divine determinism is true, it is not a matter of whether I am comfortable with the evil that is in the world, and it is not a matter of whether I like the nature and extent of the evil that is in the world. It is a matter of whether the nature and extent of the evil in the world provides a rational justification for my rejecting either the goodness of God or divine determinism. The argument I offered was not intended to make any of us more ready to accept the evil that is in the world. I don't think it can do that. Indeed, I think it would be horrible if it did succeed to do that. We shouldn't be comfortable with an accepting of the evil that is in the world. Frankly, the evil in the world is intolerable. I think that is God's own perspective toward it, and it should be ours as well. God finds the evil in the world intolerable, and so should we. It would be a big mistake to get comfortable with and tolerant of the evil that exists in the world. We should grieve at the evil in the world and not be okay with it. What's more, some of the evil in the world is horribly and awesomely terrible. Some of it is such a grotesque distortion of what human existence should be that I should have a strong and intense emotional revulsion toward it. There would be something wrong with me if I didn't. But my strong emotional revulsion must not be construed as proof that such an evil must necessarily be meaningless and without any good outcome in the ultimate scheme of things. I cannot know that. I do not know that. Yes, you are right. I must confess that what I wanted is an argument that would convince me to like the way God is scripting this reality. Frankly, I don't like everything that he does and everything that he allows. I don't think I am alone in wanting someone to offer me a different perspective that can show me how I can like it. But your argument doesn't do that. But then, as you were saying, you never claimed that it would do that. Exactly right. And I would go further and say that it would be wrong for us to like everything that God does and everything that he scripts. From the Bible perspective, not even God likes everything that he scripts. Just because he wills it all doesn't mean he likes it all. There are some very grievous, sorrow, and tragic elements within the fabric of this world. By its very nature, tragedy is not likable. Tragedy can be significantly meaningful, but it is not likable. To say it again, there would be something terribly wrong with us if we actually liked tragedy for its sorrow and not for its meaning and significance. I think what we all hope for is an argument that will show us how we can look at the horribly evil things in the world in such a way that we can directly see and know what good purpose they serve. And your argument has not shown me that that's right, and no argument ever could. We would have to be God himself to see directly and clearly how every evil accomplishes some greater good purpose or contributes to some greater meaning. we do not have a perspective from which we could see that. Indeed, it is not possible for us to have such a perspective. We are not God. We are His creatures. The end. So we have about a half hour here for comments, questions, objections.
When you were talking about, in general, we're taken care of, and tragedy and people is an aberration. I was thinking that an objection could be made that, well, yeah, it looks like that to you because you're a privileged American. Take somebody who grew up in a war-torn country, has never known a day where they didn't experience hunger, and sometimes terror, you know, fleeing into the jungle in the middle of the night because people are coming and trying to kill you. You watch your mother and sisters be raped and killed, your father having his arms hacked off, I mean, all this kind of thing. And if that person were sitting here now listening, they'd say, well, I suppose technically I am still alive, so God has kept me alive, but I'd like to show you my machete scars, and, you know, I have chronic health issues that will never go away because I didn't have adequate nutrition growing up. So how do you deal with someone? We really are privileged Americans. How do you deal with someone who hasn't had our privilege?
I think that puts us at a disadvantage because being as isolated and protected from some of the suffering that exists in the world as we are, we imagine how miserable those people must be who are going through it. We don't know firsthand. We're imagining. To give any and actual experience is often very different than how we imagine it to be. That this really came home to me. And as you know, I used to teach classes at Peninsula Bible Church in Palo Alto, and I lived in San Jose, which in the middle of the night was maybe only a 15 or 20 minute drive, and it was 2 or 2.5 hours during the day. But I would sometimes teach a class and then be talking until 1:30, 2:30 in the morning, and I'd be driving home in the middle of the night. And there were a couple of times where, you know, being apart from Jody and our children, I just sort of get this panic, like, you know, what if the house is burned down and they're dead? And the horror of what I was imagining was so horrible that I literally had to shut my mind down and stop thinking about it, or I was going to destroy myself. I was going to self-destruct. I mean, I was just overwhelmed by the horror of the thought of what I was imagining and thinking. And I couldn't, in the horror that came to mind when I thought of losing a child. What if you lost a child? That would be absolutely horrible. Well, the day came when I did lose my child. And when I did lose my child, what was interesting is how bearable it was as compared to how unbearable the imagining of that was to me. And that's the difference between an imagined horror and a real, actual horror. And I think the reason for that is because, as anyone experienced who undergoes a tragedy, I think there's a built-in God-given anesthesia. You call it numb. How often people feel like, oh, I'm just numb. Well, I think that's real. Because God gives you a God-given anesthetic to go along with the tragedy to help you just make it through until you can come out of the numbness. And that's given you time to kind of come to terms with, resolve, reflect on, and come to accept and embrace the tragedy that God has given you. And that was my experience. I mean, I was numb. It wasn't an excruciating pain. I was just numb. It happened. What do I do now? Where do I go from here? And I almost felt guilty. I mean, a bigger problem for me was the guilt I felt for not feeling worse than I did. I had to come to terms with that. So we Americans, sitting where we sit with the kinds of lives, we can imagine what it's like in another part of the world, a war-torn part of the world, and so on. But we're not actually living through it. We're just imagining what it must be like to live through it. Well, the thing I have to remember is, even in a war torn, I mean, what I imagine is that it is nonstop, 24/7 shelling, hacking, raping, pillaging, but that's 24/7. But if you actually were in a situation like that, the sun rises, the birds sing, there's respite. There's a period of, I mean, even bad guys get tired and can't continue there. So even in the midst of the worst kind of chaos, God gives you rest. To rest up for the next thing. Well, I don't imagine that. That's not what I'm imagining when I think of the horror. I'm thinking of all the horror and none of the rest. None of the everyday blessings also being doled out in the midst of it at the same time. So I think it puts us in a disadvantage because we actually paint a picture worse than reality is.
So someone who is a Holocaust, remembering this time in the Holocaust, in the camps, where they never had enough food, and they had inadequate clothes and had digits blackening and falling off from frostbite, from marching through the snow to work on the rails and being beaten for not working harder than they were working when it was just they didn't have adequate food. And maybe it was just because this guy had it in for me and he just wanted to beat me. And this went on for 4 years, at the end of which, all sorts of people that I loved died just before my camp was liberated. And in the midst of that, Viktor Frankl, in his book Man's Search for Meaning, actually talks about this, a girl who knew that she was going to the gas chambers the next day. And he came to talk to her. And she looked out her window and there was an almond tree in bloom. And she said that she never took spiritual accomplishments seriously. She was a frivolous young girl and concerned about frocks and makeup and boys and all this kind of thing, and she found herself in the camps, and now she looks at that almond tree blooming, and she knows tomorrow she's going to the gas chamber, and that's significant to her.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the kind of thing that you're talking about? That in the midst of horror, the fact that that there's respite, the fact that we can see beauty, and we can reflect on, I'm glad I'm not the person I used to be.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's the thing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? What does it profit a man if you don't undergo the Holocaust and you lose your soul? But how is it not worth it if through the Holocaust, in the midst of the Holocaust, you find yourself? Now, can you find your soul another way? Yeah, and that would be okay too. But what an interesting and substantive thing to be a person subjected to that kind of suffering, and in the midst of that, to go through the work and the process of finding meaning, even in the midst of the suffering, finding God in the midst of the suffering, finding yourself in the midst of the suffering, and all that. That's a neat story. A very neat story. Yeah, but somebody suffered. Okay. Somebody suffered. I mean, we just automatically go, that somehow makes it all meaningless and negates it. I don't know. I mean, it's part of the story. It's part of what makes it so interesting, is that it's actually in the midst of that suffering that all this good stuff, that it's, the suffering is being redeemed here, right? Because of the suffering, the goodness has come. Could God have done it another way? Yeah. But he didn't. Because that would have been a different story. That would have been a different life. That would have been a different storyline. And you remember, Peter, you're going to suffer. Well, what about him? That's another story.
And it seems interesting, especially having read a bunch of Holocaust novels or Holocaust-like biographies and stuff, that the people going through them. I mean, if you were brought in here to talk about it, well, what they remember and what they talk about isn't necessarily all the suffering they went through, because it's kind of, they were, are kind of like in the reverse of where we are, where we have all the good days and a couple bad days or something, but they were just having bad days. And so the highlights often of their like autobiographies or stuff are, this day I was able to acquire an extra loaf of bread or something, and we were able to share it. And it's like all these good things that's, that they pop up and notice, because it's the odd day out kind of thing amidst all the other days. So it's kind of like they even have a perspective that we wouldn't expect, that we wouldn't imagine they would have looking at it from our perspective.
Where we are tempted as Americans is to get real glib about this, because we just take all of our incredible blessing for granted and just get, I don't know what the word is, but
entitled.
Yeah, that sense of entitlement.
Of course, God's done this for me.
Yeah, we should be grateful. I mean, we're some of the wealthiest, richest people in the history of the world. Even the average American is that. What an incredible material blessing God has blessed us with.
And safety.
Safety. Yeah.
So if somebody looks more at the viewpoint that they're seeing and less on unnecessary suffering in the world, how are they able to determine or detect when suffering is meaningless and unnecessary versus meaningful and necessary?
Well,
either within their own lives or somewhere out in the world any time through history, because that's just something that I can imagine is very difficult to determine.
Notice that the majority opinion throughout all of mankind is going to be against God. So if you just sort of facilely assume that the suffering out there in the world is just way too much, there are not too many people going to challenge you. So it's a really easy assumption to make, you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because, who's going to quote?
Then how they think of unnecessary suffering? Because everybody would see it differently.
Yeah, I don't even think they don't go that far. They're just waving their hand and saying, oh, come on, look at this mess. That's inexcusable. That they're not analyzing any, they're not actually doing research and gathering empirical data and looking at each case of suffering to find out, is that inexcusable? Is that inexcusable? Has anyone found the example of inexcusable evil in the world? They're not doing that.
Because some people consider it inexcusable that a cat died in a traumatic way, and other people
I've
got bigger concerns, that's not inexcusable.
Well, and that's a very profound and telling point, because the fact that, I mean, notice, why would we find that inexcusably evil? Again, it's my empathy, my instincts, my horror, my revulsion. That's not moral judgment. I mean, you ate a cow yesterday. So that's not moral judgment. That's their feelings. I mean, that should be very telling to us.
Well, it seems, as you pointed out multiple times, that the examples that they give are often fictionalized stories, like Sartre or Camus or something, where they write a novel and say, look at all this is what the world's like, and kind of trick people's minds into forgetting that, well, yeah, but you kind of built this fiction the way you wanted it to be built. Yes, you stack the deck against any other conclusion.
And again, it's safe to do that, because the vast majority of people want to go there. That's what they want to think.
What about when we find ourselves in, almost obviously God's writing the story, but being a part of the story of evil? I recently watched a movie where a Holocaust man, I like to watch Holocaust movies, don't ask me why, was taking people to the railroad cars and, you know, walking them in, shutting the door, and they were going off. And in his mind, they were just going away. And even when he told the story, he didn't sound culpable to what was going on. He was just doing what he was supposed to be doing, and not necessarily even a job. That's just what he was supposed to be doing. And I mean, even at 80, 90 years old, whatever he was. He was, I mean, I didn't hear him say at that point. I mean, later he said something about evil in general, but he didn't say this was my part in it. I didn't hear him say I ran away and got shot, that kind of thing.
I went.
He said he didn't just say I ran away and got shot, you know, instead of, you know, opening the doors and putting the people in every time.
He didn't resist.
Right, he didn't resist. And, I mean, the idea that when we find ourselves in the midst of it, you know, an evil plot, what do we do? I think that's part of what the problem of evil is. I mean, the yeah. So.
You're, just to make it clear, you're talking about a German guard?
No, a Jewish man.
Oh, yeah. Who
so
is
they, yeah, so it was
but
a particular...
was an employee of the Germans?
No.
Well, his job at the camp was to put people on the train,
yes.
To send them
so,
off.
So,
I mean, people dug ditches. His job was to put people on trains.
Yes. And there probably were guards there, but they weren't pointing the guns at him. He knew. I'm sure he knew that they were there for a reason.
Yeah. If he doesn't, he either cooperates or gets killed, probably. So.
And I think that's what we do in America. You know, that we justify evil that goes around us because we may not be directly. Having evil happening, that sort of thing. So it's more subtle than a Holocaust.
Yeah, I think that's true. But with respect to that, I think what's important is it's one of the youthful lusts that we need to flee is the lust for purity. We would like to, in fact, I mean, that my early time as a Christian was sort of tortured in trying to figure out, okay, how do I live a perfectly obedient life as a disciple of Jesus? How do I keep my life untainted and uncompromised by any evil? Only young people can think that. I mean, because when you get to know enough about reality, we are all implicated in evil. That just by breathing, I am implicated in evil. I can't extract myself from this evil world. Of course, if we count indirect guilt, we are chock full to the brim with indirect guilt.
But that's your taking responsibility versus what you're talking about, the feeling part, where people respond to the feeling. They don't take responsibility, or like, they don't own the reality. They like you said, use their imagination. You know, so instead of owning the reality of the world being evil, or even my part in it, they imagine something different. You know?
Yeah, and let themselves somehow off the hook and justify their action or something. But yeah, we blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. That the constant state of the disciple of Jesus should be, the child of God, should be mourning. And I don't mean we're crying all the time, but what I mean is I should face squarely and directly into the reality that my whole life is wrong. This whole created order is wrong and it needs to be redeemed. And I'm a part of that. Instead of me kind of trying to, in my imagination, my rationalization, take myself out of it or above it, well, that's evil, but I'm not. I should just admit I'm neck deep in it. I'm a part of it. And I don't even have the power to change that. It's evil and I can't fix it. But young people want to fix it. And get incredibly self-righteous and incredibly misled into really destructive causes because we're going to fix the world. You guys screwed it up, you older people screwed it up, but we're going to fix the world. Yeah, good luck with that.
Every generation before you has said that.
Mm-hmm.
I remember... In the midst of counseling with someone, I was the counselor, they were the counselor, Larry Barber, in fact, and we were talking about, I can't remember what we were talking about, and in the midst of that, all of a sudden, I realized that the image I had, we were talking about something I was struggling with, not very successfully, and the image I had of myself was sort of like a sterling silver teapot with a little bit of tarnish on it, and all I had to do was just do a little polish here, everything would be fine. And all of a sudden I realized I am this teapot that's a silver plated thing, and the plate is wearing off, it's been kicked around on the freeway, and It's got holes in it, so it doesn't hold more than a millimeter of tea anymore. And, I mean, my whole, something happened, and all of a sudden my whole vision of who I was before God just made this flip. And instead of being somebody who's fundamentally, you know, I'm pretty solid, you know, okay, I could use some tweaking, but, you know, which of us don't? I'm like, man, I'm really messed up. I mean, there's no way I could get enough silver polish and solder and anything to fix this mess that I'm in.
Yeah.
I am really majorly messed up.
Yeah, exactly. And that's very much at the heart of the gospel. In hope we have been saved. But hope that is seen is not hope. I mean, what I look forward to is the day when I will be recreated. And then I will be, you said sterling silver?
Yeah.
Pure sterling, untarnished sterling silver. Then I will be. But no way I can get there in this lifetime. I'm too much a part of this dark, evil age, too much a part of this world that has been subjected to futility. Everything is corrupt.
Am I right in reading that the argument that you're making in the second half of this isn't so much that we can know that all suffering leads to good, or that all evil is excusable or not inexcusable, but that we can't know that, and since we can't know, we shouldn't be making the assumption that God is evil.
Right.
And or the assumption that either that God is evil or that divine determinism is evil,
right,
in effect.
And then I'm going a step further, and I'm saying, in fact, we have some awfully good reasons for thinking that God is in fact good, and therefore that whatever evil I see must make sense, must be meaningful. So that's the next step.
So you do, okay.
And your deal that you were talking about, that a steel company, when I first moved up here, that I was sitting next to a fellow programmer who was also a believer, and the guy who owned the steel company, it was VE Day or something like that, and he was over a couple of cubes away talking to somebody, and he said, the only thing Hitler did wrong was he didn't kill enough Jews. And and my colleague and I looked at each other, and she looked at me and she said, I don't think I can continue to work for this company. I'm putting money in the pocket of a guy who feels like that. Who knows what the heck he's doing with that money? I said, well, he's probably buying groceries at Safeway. He's probably paying his mortgage, and, you know, he may be supporting a neo-Nazi group or something. But at the time, I thought, but if he is, I mean, very often, nowadays it's real fashionable to vote with your wallet, so we want to protest somebody's political views, we don't buy from this company, we encourage all our friends not to buy from this company. I don't know if that's right or wrong, and we had a very short and not really satisfying conversation about what is our obligation here. Should we quit our job and just let him know? Or we can't work for you, given the way that you think Hitler was a good guy. What do you think?
Well, I think there might come time and place where individuals are called to rather drastic, dramatic statements in their resistance and opposition to evil. But we are kidding ourselves if we think, well, if I just stop working for him, then I have removed myself from supporting any evil. I mean, my goodness, whoever's paying me a salary is supporting evil.
Just because
they're
evil. Because
I'm evil. I mean, so unless we all put all of our money in a trust account for Jesus when he comes back, how are you not supporting me in everything that you do? Now, which is not to say that there may not come a time and place where we are called by God, resist this evil and resist it now. But that's an individual call.
Well, this was news to us. I mean, we've never heard anything like that, and I suspect it was an unguarded statement by an elderly man whose mind was in the process of going. But if his company...
I mean, even if you thought it, why would you...
Well, his company was a well-respected company with lots of little decent, hard-working people, and it did a good... It had a good product, and it was succeeding where the economy was not really great in the early 80s, and it was succeeding because it did a good product at a reasonable price. And so there was all this other good stuff. If he had, you know, was flying a Nazi flag over the company grounds and made a big deal out of it or whatever, and I think I might have had to remove myself from that. But this, you know, nobody would have ever guessed, and we never would have if we hadn't overheard this this rather sort of mumbled comment to somebody, you know, just a few cubes over. So it's just a matter of hours, really.
Jack, would you put yourself in the role of a detractor of divine determinism and explain, as one of those detractors, that if God is not responsible for evil, what is?
Yeah, I mean, you have to come up with a lot of different sources. mankind is evil, that's a big one. Nature, well, nature is just kind of grinds along doing what nature does, and sometimes we get in the way. It's nobody's fault, and it's not, there's no one responsible for evil, there's no real evil going on, it's just tragic circumstances. So natural evil, you'd probably explain that way. Human evil, you explain because humans are evil and they have a free will.
Satan,
you may resort to Satan. Most detractors of the divine determinism probably don't believe in Satan, so. But some Christians who believe are theists.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'd be more of a Christian.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Satan. Yeah, Satan would be a big deal.
The big Christian way is usually that, in a sense, God and Satan, and then maybe angels and demons are slightly below them, but they're all kind of on the same level. But and they'll probably do have it at least. Conceptually, more of the house thing where there's a spiritual story and then there's our story down the bottom, and God and Satan and the angels and spirit stuff are up on the other level, and so God and Satan are duking it out, and all the bad stuff that happens is Satan's fault, usually, somehow, or his demons.
God loses. God's going to win the war, but he loses some skirmishes.
He loses some battles. Yeah. Okay. Because I think I was. Before I understood the concept or even thought about it, I don't think I thought it through enough to be able to answer that question. There was just evil out there, but I hadn't thought what its origin was. God just allowed bad things to happen. He could take care of them if he wanted to. He had the power, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never found, even before I believed in divine determinism and all that stuff, I always had a problem with that answer because... Aren't you even more culpable if you had the power to stop it and you didn't? It's one thing to not stop it because you don't have the wherewithal, but if you could have, but you didn't, that you got some splaining to do, it seems to me.
Well, you never read Job. Apparently you never read Job.
Yeah. Had enough?
Thank you, Jack.